Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
Welcome to MacGuffin Men. I'm Alex, and with me is James. Before we get started, I just want to let you know we've been having some website troubles, so our last couple episodes haven't been up on iTunes yet. They've just been on SoundCloud, and you are probably listening to this one on SoundCloud as well. Hopefully, going to get those website issues figured out soon, but I'm a dummy when it comes to that stuff, and James is no better. No offense, James. But yeah, that's not what we're talking about today. So, what are we talking about today, Marty?
I'm Marty.
I think if we have to split the two, I think I'm Rust. If
okay.
If you're Troy and I'm Abed, then I'm Rust and you're Marty. I feel like that's just how the way it's got to work.
All right. That's a tough one. All right. We're talking about True Detective. Clearly very seriously.
Yeah.
Yes, we are talking about the at time of recording recently finished True Detective.
Yeah. Like not even 24 hours ago.
I know.
We're on our fucking game today.
Yeah, man. It's hot.
New shit.
A show we watched almost from the beginning. You watched from the start, right?
Yeah. And then once I was like confident that you would like it, I told you you would like it.
Yes. And I remember you saying it's a show that involves a lot of guessing, as it's kind of a whodunit murder mystery.
Mm-hmm.
Now that we've seen the conclusion of it, do you still feel that that's the case?
Well, I don't know that I would have described it as a whodunit murder mystery. Because I think I knew pretty early on that all of the let's look at all of the little clues that they're giving us, and there will be some big conspiracy revealed in the final episode or something. I was pretty confident that wasn't going to be the case.
Why do you think that?
Because the way things were going, it reminded me so much of, like, I don't know, the things I liked about the first couple episodes of True Detective were because it was very much like Seven. And Seven is kind of my jam when it comes to serial killer things. And I just sort of felt like the point of the series was always going to be about something more than who the murderer was. Yeah,
we get the, but in Seven we get a murderer and
yeah, but it, like,
all our questions answered mostly, don't we?
Yeah, but his name was John Doe. He didn't, like, he didn't do, it was all, like, his whole thing was, it was like a mixture of Watchmen and No Country for Old Men, you know? He just wanted to make, it was more about society than it was ever about who it was, you know?
Yeah.
Like, he wasn't a notable person. It wasn't like people suspecting Maggie's father was the Yellow King or something, you know?
Yeah. It wasn't like one of their neighbors or someone higher up at the police force or something like that. It was kind of just a villain to have a villain.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is not to say Seven's a bad movie, because we know that's not the case.
Seven is a super legit movie. I will punch anybody that says otherwise.
But part of this, I think a lot of people's enjoyment, and it certainly doesn't sound like yours, but has been rewatching for little clues and, you know, assembling all their little theories on message boards and rereading late 19th century horror novels to try to see any literary parallels. I think a lot of people's enjoyment of that series has come from kind of doing their own little police work viewers.
That's the way things typically tend to be with these things. And I understand it for sure.
Mm-hmm. And I more susceptible to that kind of stuff than you are, as far as making theories and kind of researching and seeing other people's takes on it.
Yep.
And very early on in the show, we get a character say, when you attach assumption, you start to bend the narrative. So, you know, they were saying this in reference to their police work and, you know, this main case of finding these young dead women. But it's easy to see how that mentality applies to this kind of viewership detective work that a lot of people are participating in.
Yeah, for sure.
Oh, and it's like, you know, with that quote in mind, it's funny to read people's theories who are like, oh, it has to be this because they said this, this, and this. Yeah. And really not much comes of it. How did you feel about the ending?
Are we talking like the very ending or like the final episode or
The final episode for starters.
I thought it was fantastic.
Yeah.
I made the mistake of watching it at 2 a.m. last night. It terrified me, like in a way that very few things ever have. And I thought the first 3 minutes where we're just at the killer's house was so unsettling. And just, I don't know. It was fucking great. I loved it.
Wait, what was unsettling about incest in a dirty rundown?
Yeah, exactly.
I love the bayou.
Exactly that. And then like the actual action of the episode was very very heart pounding. In a way that I didn't think they'd be able to top from the episodes 4 and 5, but I think they totally did.
Okay. Yeah. And what about the very, very ending?
I'm not sure because there's a point where they're talking about as they start to talk about the stars and Marty's like, well, it looks to me like the darkness is winning. I was like, oh, are they just going full blown? Like everything is terrible always. And, you know, they give you a minute to sort of think about that before Rust says, you know, I mean, there used to be no stars at all. If you look, I prefer to look at it as, you know, the light is winning, some variation of that. I don't know how I feel about it. I think I like it better than the darkness winning. But yeah, I don't think it makes a point that I think sort of, it's not great. Like I like it, but I didn't love it. Like I wasn't like, yeah, go stars, you know? But yeah, I don't know.
Okay. Well, it was interesting to see kind of the positive ending coming from Rust Cole's mouth.
Yeah.
and you know, as interesting as Marty Hart is and Woody Harrelson's performance and a lot of other things that I do enjoy a lot about this show, Rust Cole's really the show stealer, right?
Oh yeah, for sure.
Yeah, he's kind of everyone's you know, takeaway from this show is what an interesting character and what a weird and dark and at times hilarious character.
Well, yeah, and even if right from the beginning, if we're just going for the first couple episodes, he just is the one that jumps out. Like Marty's more normal, and Rust is just like constantly spouting his crazy philosophies and like just saying ludicrous shit like everybody's nobody, and he's just dropping those like every four lines in the first couple episodes. And so they very clearly want you to stick with Rust more than Marty. Like they want you to care about Marty, but Rust is much more important for the show.
Yeah, he's the more unique and more interesting character. And yeah, especially right at the get-go, we are very much meant to be aligned with Marty. And I mean, we like Rust and he's entertaining, but just because he's so out there, even if we don't really like Marty eventually, definitely from the get-go, we're supposed to be aligned with him. And very early on, as like, you know, just after they've started working together and they kind of get down to some of the brass tacks of Rust theories, he says, I think human consciousness was a misstep in evolution. We became too self-aware. Nature created an aspect of nature separate from itself. And then there's a couple beats and Marty says, well, that sounds god fucking awful, Rust. Like this show, I mean, some people call it a little pretentious, a little high-minded, especially a lot of you know, Rust just spouting philosophy seemingly out of nowhere. But it's not like that's the whole show, and it's written as so we understand that he's very much an anomaly, and he's very, very out there. And we get Russ saying things like that once in a while to bring him back to Earth.
Yeah, he's kind of like a way I described Russ to somebody recently was he's kind of the guy that's been woken up from the Matrix, but is still living in the Matrix and can't get out of it. It's sort of like that type of thing. Like, he knows it's all, and like, he's 100% confident that it all means nothing, but he's stuck there still, you know?
Yeah. Hmm. And I saw someone's take on Rust and kind of how he does, as you said, he's aware these kind of these people's feelings and what they do as, you know, kind of pointless and meaningless. And he has, you know, been awakened or cut himself off from that. And basically their take on Rust is that he used to be, you know, not just in touch with things, but very sensitive to things. And, you know, only someone who could feel emotions and, you know, love and interpersonal connection that strongly has to work so hard to, you know, eviscerate and deny those feelings of love and connection. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the way he talks about what happened with his daughter and the way his relationship has fallen apart.
And his past in the deep undercover for 4 years, I think it was, when the limit's supposed to be 11 months.
Yeah, it's. No one would ever kind of talk this way about emotions unless in a way they kind of got burned by it. Like, they allowed themselves to feel so much that it got the better of them and it kind of got out of control. And now he, in an attempt to control that again, he just never feels anything or tries his best to stop feeling anything ever again. And that's why he's, you know, as dark and as cold as he is. And I noticed that's kind of a very classic character trait in noir storytelling. And you know, you'll have a hero or even a bad guy who seems very cold and very separated from things, and it's just something in his past, you know, got to be a little, you know, too real. And now he's kind of cut everything off, and that's very much what we see with Rust, and very much comes full circle by the end. Were you okay with his somewhat spiritual awakening at the end, or did it not have anything to do really with spirituality for you?
No, because I think it makes sense. I kind of liked his explanation because the way the explanation worked kind of made sense. As far as, like, I mean, I've never been that close to death, so I mean, I can't speak to what it's like, but it seemed like a logical jump for this type of character to have in that moment. And I liked him talking about how he had given up and he just came back. And, you know, he woke up, and I like that a lot.
Okay.
Yeah.
something that you mentioned on a lot of these podcasts and discussing a lot of movies and TV show and stuff is the idea of truth. And that certainly gets played a lot, played with a lot in this show.
Yeah.
And, you know, I rewatched every episode before we recorded this. And something I completely missed the first time around, which I've seen in some other things but still liked again, is the very beginning of the first episode. Do you remember how it starts?
It's the, like, a field being set on fire, right?
Yeah, it's what we now can assume was Errol, our Scarface man, putting the body by the tree and then setting it on fire. And then do you remember what happens right after that?
It's a shot of a camera lens.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. I really like that a lot. I like how we kind of get the setup that, you know, there is definitely a murder here. Like, this is, as much as things kind of get subjective and we eventually get a lot of disconnect between what's being spoken about as a memory and the true nature of what happened at that time being described. We get this murder right away, and that's true. And, you know, there are definitely... there's definitely a dead body. There's definitely people dying. There's definitely this very bad force taking what we can guess are innocent lives. And then, yeah, the shot of the camera lens. And then from then on, we get, you know, the series of interviews at on our three different timelines and footage of, you know, what's being described. And I just love that shot of the camera lens that, you know, kind of gives us the idea that now everything can be a construction. Like, we don't really know what's going to be true now, and that's going to be played with a lot. There's a lot of deception and a lot of, you know, planned lies and, you know, conspiracy theories. Not only the conspiracy theory that we're looking for of you know, Tuttle's Church and all these, you know, police, I don't even know, like cabals, I don't know, whatever it is, these, you know, elite little subcultures of people who, you know, murder and, you know, rape and all these really unpleasant things. Mm-hmm. But we also have the, you know, the construction of Marty and Rust's history, mm-hmm. and especially the Reggie. That's when we see them go really, their actions really go kind of off the script of what they've been telling.
Yeah. But I'd sort of view the, like, I view the sort of the storytelling of sort of like the 90s storyline, when they're showing that, I view that as a pretty objective thing of what they want us to think actually happened, and not like just for the story, you know, like when they're telling a different story, that's fine. But like the actual footage that we're seeing from the 90s is supposed to be like an objective, like this is what happened type of thing. Right.
Yeah. I think what we're shown is always pretty true.
It's that's always how I took it.
Yeah, it's, but I guess the first one is when Rust says he took some time off to go visit his sick dad.
Yeah.
In rewatching it, I think that's the first time where what's being said is not what's being shown.
Yeah, that would have been my guess as well.
Yeah, and so Rust talks about going to visit his father up in Alaska, and then we really actually see what he did with that time, and that was, you know, going back undercover and meeting up with the Iron Crusaders.
Yep.
And then, obviously, the major case of things going wrong would be the Reggie Ledoux shootout scene.
Yeah.
And I really loved kind of how long they play that out and never really address the deception of it all.
Mm-hmm.
Like, when they're talking, when Rust and Marty separately are talking to the two cops now, you know, essentially investigating Rust.
Mm-hmm.
We get probably a good 20-30 minutes of that scene being described entirely separate from what actually went down.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's a bit of a bigger estimate, but yes, no, it's definitely quite a, and we even get sort of their actual deposition from the 90s about it cut in as well, which is kind of nice. Or at least maybe a review of the shooting, something sort of like that, where they're sitting in front of this panel of sorts. And yeah, there's definitely a long period of time where they're telling their story instead of telling the story, and yeah, it's pretty great.
Yeah, and even when Marty's describing the shooting, and he's kind of states, you know, I've already done my deposition. We already have all this down. And he says, I'll tell it to you the same way I've told it 17 years ago and the same way I tell it at every cop bar between here and, you know, New Orleans or whatever he says, because it only went down the one way. And it's a very incorrect statement. Like, it couldn't be, you know, more false. He's saying, of course, I've done this already. And the reason it's going to be the same is because it only went down the one way. And, you know, we have that dialogue, and then on screen we have an entirely different an accurate statement of a depiction of what really happened while he's telling lies over it.
Mm-hmm.
And I really enjoyed that part a lot. And I like kind of the meta approach that this show takes of, you know, as I said, by showing the camera lens so early, the way it talks about, you know, truth and stories. I like how this show seems to look at itself as a story while playing with the ideas that stories, can be false and can be manipulated.
Yeah, for sure.
And, you know, from that kind of subjective angle, we see Rust hallucinating very early on, mm-hmm. and how that is real for him. And we see it kind of not just through his eyes, but we see it from behind him. So we get him and his hallucination in the shot. And this is right before we start getting into positions being so much different from the truth. And so, you know, a quarter of the way into this show, we're already being exposed to this idea that we have very unreliable narrators, and that the story is really far from what it seems.
Yeah, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Good stuff.
It sounds like you're Rust having your first sip of beer on a Thursday.
It's past noon.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Marty a bit.
Okay.
Because we've talked about Rust.
Yep.
Marty's, what, slightly less interesting than Rust, but still a good character to you?
I would say the things Rust says are more interesting as sort of like little sentences to think about. But I feel like as a character, if we're trying to view him as a person, I feel like Marty might be more interesting to me. Because I really enjoy the idea, and this plays into what you were talking about. Marty's a shitty person, and particularly in the 90s, and the way he talks about it to sort of justify it to himself, I find really fascinating.
Like what?
He makes a lot of excuses about how his drinking and cheating on his wife is basically good for the family. I don't remember the actual quote that he says, but it's not that far away from what I just said. And he just sort of views it as, in this situation, it's better for the family that I have sex with somebody that's not my wife, and it's better for the family that I drink. And even though, you know, I kind of have a problem with it. And I find that really interesting. And and his wife, Maggie, really sums it up when she's being interviewed in 2012, I guess it is, right?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Yeah, and she says Rust knew exactly who he was, Marty never knew himself. And I think that's sort of, that's the difference between those two characters, and I think kind of what makes Marty more interesting, because he does all sorts of crazy things and then tries to kind of justify them, and whereas Rust would sort of just be like, well, I mean, you know, nothing matters, so who cares? You know, and that's the thing I find interesting about Marty. And I mean, this is such a tiny thing to pick on, but this is True Detective, so people like to talk about the tiny things. Marty's Pink Floyd shirt, I really, really enjoy, because it's probably something he values as something that makes him sort of seem different, but only in a really common sort of different, because Pink Floyd is sort of like this, the way they're viewed is kind of this outlier of making weird music, but they were also so goddamn popular that
and still are.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you can't use them as an identifier for, you know, having yourself stand away from the pack a bit, you know?
Yeah. So. Yeah. Marty's not a good person. That's,
no.
That's pretty clear. I do like a lot of buying it, but him explaining it and...
sorry, what?
Not just him, not really him... justifying his actions, but mm-hmm. explaining them. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, it wasn't infidelity that was his problem, it was the inattention. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's related to the case we learned, but he kind of thinks if he can stop the cheating and drinking, then that's the problem solved. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, those are symptomatic of him not really caring about his family or maybe himself as much as a healthy person would.
Yeah.
You know, and we see him lash out on his mistress's boyfriend.
Yeah.
he kind of puts himself in an impossible spot where, you know, he has a whole other family and expects his, you know, his mistress to be just for him. Which
yeah,
is
exactly.
Completely unacceptable.
Yeah, exactly.
As far as kind of being a, you know, typical cop, he seems kind of stereotypical in a lot of ways, you know, kind of the drinking, cheating cop who, mm-hmm. You know, still loves God. And, you know, that's one of his problems with Rust.
Yeah, but, exactly. See 80 of the 1,000 characters on The Wire.
Yeah, exactly. But I do kind of like how this show, you know, in so many ways it is a police procedural like so many other ones, and in mm-hmm. a lot of ways it's not. And one moment with Marty that I really like is when he's at the strip club trying to find information and the bartender's not really being very forthcoming with the knowledge. And he says, you know, we run a clean business here. He doesn't really care that Marty's a cop. And he says, how are you going to run when you're shut down for 6 months for a grand jury investigation? Yeah. Why do you make me say this shit? I really like that part a lot. It's like a small little thing, but just kind of going back to that, this show being aware it's a show. And, you know, that line is almost word for word and every cop show or movie ever made.
Yeah.
And I just kind of like that little half step back to say, like, well, he's sick of it. The audience is sick of hearing lines like this. Like, let's just, I'm a cop. Let's just get to the next plot point where I don't have to, you know, puff my chest out and do all this stuff. The show is a lot like so many other cop shows, and it's got, you know, the two cops who don't like each other at the start, and then there's the case of their lives that, you know, makes them get back together and finally see eye to eye. And it's got the maybe corrupt force, and it's got the task force coming in to take the case away. And, you know, and it's about mostly about dead female prostitutes, which is kind of the most basic, really dark plot for a cop show that there is.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, lines like that with the, why do you make me say this shit?
You forgot, like, the Rust Colt type of character, which is, like, there's a character on, I guess it's NCIS. I always get them mixed up. The Matthew Gray Goobler character on one of those cop shows that's just sort of like, I've seen the scene, and now this, and this are true, you know? And it's just, and Rust is very much a play on that type of character, and that's something I like a lot about Rust. But sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. But.
No, it's fine. And he's got, you know, that dark past and all that kind of stuff. I think it just does a good job of being a kind of a classic cop show and doing a lot of the things that we love about police procedurals, but definitely being unlike any other show I've seen before.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess we should talk about the format just a little bit and kind of how they got a consistent feeling, because it was always going to be 8 episodes, all written by Nick Pizzolatto, all directed by Cary Joji Fukunaga. And they just had a story that they wanted to tell. And they had, a beginning, middle, and end. It wasn't going to get picked up for 5 more episodes, and they had to stretch it out. It wasn't going to get picked up for another season, so we have to have some of the criminals, you know, stay on the loose or whatever.
Yeah.
People say it's kind of like a novelistic approach. Like, we have this one story. It's more like a mini series or an anthology or a long film or a good novel than it is like a TV show that let's just throw some stars in, throw some money at it, and see how long we can get it to go for and how many, you know, commercials we can sell.
Yeah.
Do you think that, like, does that come through? Do you find this to be a very consistent show for that reason?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. Not that... I do think a big part of the show, even more, I mean, for the writing, I think it's obviously helpful to always have just one voice writing every word whenever possible. But for the direction, I think the biggest part, and this is going to make it sound like I don't think Cary Fukunaga is good at his job, but he 100% is. But I think the biggest thing about the direction of the show is that it's clearly a very high budget show. They were able to shoot on film, which is not a thing that you can do without having a high budget anymore. And it looks like they were able to sort of take their time in the setup. And this isn't uncommon on HBO shows, but I think even for an HBO show, this looks particularly expensive. And I think even more than the actual having like one person behind the camera the whole time, I think the money can be even more important. That being said, I think this is a spectacularly directed show. And it's kind of, that's the thing that drew me in, because I'm less into, I think the mystery aspect of the show than you are, and most people are. But it's sort of, it was the filmmaking that got me, like the opening of the field on fire. It was great. Shot a close up of the lens. Great. And then the moment where I was just like, you know what, I'm going to definitely keep watching the show, is when they're rolling up to the Dora Lang scene, and Rust opens his door, and the camera's clearly attached to the door, but they let the camera open with the door a little bit, but not the whole way. And it's just sort of like this really nice moment where it's just like, okay, this is a mentality I can get behind, you know? This is a thought process that I like.
And, yeah. And our long tracking shot in episode 4.
Is there a long tracking shot in the show? I haven't talked about that at length to anybody who will listen.
Okay, well, now talk about it on the podcast.
It's spectacular. I got a minute into the shot and was just like, wow, that's a minute long unbroken take. And then it went on for another 5 minutes.
Right. Well, which scene is it for people who might not know?
People know. It's the scene, okay. Like the raid, okay. The raid with Ginger. Yeah. And we just sort of, it gives you this really great feel for where Rust is in this place and the geography of the place that they're in. And I mean, we talked about this on our 12 Years a Slave podcast as well, but anytime you can do a scene without cutting, it just sort of is able to bring you more further into the scene, dialogue or otherwise. And if it's a scene that's as exciting as this, then it's pretty great. And, you know, we see Rust go through the whole house when they go in through the first building, and then we see him go out and go into another house, use the phone, go out, and then go outside around a house. But we go into the house and see these guys loading their guns, and then we see Rust avoiding them, and then we see Rust going over a fence with Ginger and getting into the car with Marty. It's bananas. It's awesome. I love it. There's all sorts of mixing with light sources going on, and that's always a nice thing to do, and is clearly a indicative of a thoughtful director of photography. And it's just great.
Yeah, and it's, I was, when watching it again, I was trying to see where there's action in the show. There's what we talked about where Marty kind of breaks into his girlfriend's house and beats up that guy. Mm-hmm. That's almost all the action we have up until this point.
Yeah, exactly.
And it just makes that one so powerful because, you know, it's a really violent, fast-paced scene. You know, on its own, it would have been such a transition. But, you know, as you said, just being in kind of Marty's shoes like that and following him for so long, separating from him, going back to him, and just really just immerses you in that scene so well. Mm-hmm. And to end an episode like that was just, you know, just always just really left me wanting more.
And, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, wonderful scene.
And I mean, you've got that little scene once they get inside the car. But then the last shot of that episode, I think, is amazing, where we just sort of get the helicopter shot of the environment that he just went through. And we can sort of pick out where he was. It's like, oh, this and this and this and this. And and then that helicopter just comes along in front of the camera and the episode ends. And that shot's amazing, and like the whole last 10 minutes of that episode is so great. And wonderful, wonderful show for these things. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Were you kind of at all let down by how much, I know this isn't really, as you said, this is more the mystery aspect, so this isn't so much yours, but did you think that they spent too much time with the, you know, Christian cults and the kind of corrupt police force, and then ended up being pretty much the actions of one person and maybe hidden a little bit after the fact, but mostly just one guy?
Yeah, but no, because I think it's sort of the, I don't know, maybe red herring is too extreme of a term for them, but, or like, I suppose they are, but I think the idea is to show that the killer ended up being a product of that environment. And we spend so much time seeing all these institutions become corrupted. You mentioned potentially the justice system, the church, school, their schools, the institution of marriage is corrupted, politics, all these things. And I think the idea is to sort of like they spend so much time showing these wide shots of Louisiana. It's supposed to show a decrepit environment that can create this type of evil. And so no, I don't think they spent too much time on it. And if it wasn't interesting, I would, like, even just in the moment when you're watching it, if it wasn't interesting, then yes, they would have. But it was all interesting, even if it didn't have some big, like, one sentence revelation tied to it, you know, because I think it was all very, very important. And I think that's the idea they want to get across from the killer, with the killer, you know, because he's the son of this corrupt sheriff, correct?
Yeah.
And the Tuttle family clearly has ties to them. So,
it wasn't really, you know, as much of a conspiracy. And then so much of what Russ has been talking about for the longest time is being an individual. And the fact that it kind of came down to more of just one person than this big conspiracy that you could, you know, put up on your wall of your storage unit and draw strings between and
get,
you know,
a cork board, get all Claire Danes and Homeland on it.
Exactly. It wasn't that. And I think it also just speaks to, you know, being a cop and all the things that you have to just kind of look into and kind of, you know, follow the string till its end and run down all these leads. And, you know, ultimately it was something that they kind of had early on, you know, and that's part of Rust's regrets near the end is how early on they met this guy and how many times they heard
of curse.
Yeah, exactly. How many times they heard about this big guy with scars on his face and they met him in 95. And they've been, you know, running around for however many years.
He does have a beard when they see him in 95, correct? Am I right in thinking that? There's certainly some sort of I definitely remember something obscuring his face, because once we saw him again, it was like, oh, it's that guy.
And, yeah. Was it just grass clippings or something?
Maybe it could have been. Because, I mean, Russ talks about how he had dirt on his face or whatever. But either way, he didn't have a lot of time to look at him, you know, before they had to run to Reggie.
Yeah. And it kind of just speaks to that that quote early on about just attaching meaning to something and going all the way with it. Like, we keep hearing about these things and it keeps getting kind of pointed to. So, you know, we look for the clues and it's, again, exactly, the detective's curse. It was right in front of them the whole time, and they were looking for something else.
Yeah. One thing I just want to point this out real quick. We talked about all the corrupted institutions. I found it so funny when Marty was playing golf with the sheriff, who they used to work with in the department in the 90s, and he's talking about the Fontenot girl, and then he just immediately says, "Now watch this," and hits a drive. And it reminded me of so much of George W. Bush saying, "Now watch this drive."
Yeah.
And I thought that was a nice little, whether or not they intended it as a tie-in for you know, some shitty person in charge of an institution, I found it very funny and enjoyed it quite a bit.
Yeah, no, I like that. I like that sheriff guy a lot.
Yeah, he's in Orange is the New Black as well, and he's very good in it.
Okay. I like when they snipe up his car too.
Yeah, I love that.
So much overkill. Like, one shot definitely would have done the trick and raised much fewer questions.
Silent bar owner doesn't play that way.
No, absolutely.
It's five shots or nothing.
Absolutely. Yeah. I like the broken taillight that results between the fight between Rust and Marty. Did that bug you as a visual metaphor, or were you down with that?
No, I was fine with it, because it's they don't harp on it. It's just sort of, it's just broken and it's still broken, you know. And I mean, there's no shot of him, it, like, had the series ended with Rust getting the taillight on his truck fixed, I feel like that would have been problematic, to say the least.
But. Or the two of them installing a new taillight together and then going their separate ways.
Yeah, and it's just, it's the first frame of the show that's set up like a normal Norman Rockwell painting.
That sounds awful.
Yeah, they're listening to, like, I don't know, who's some Travis Tritt or something. Some real American.
Sure. That sounds country enough.
Yeah.
Anything else about True Detective?
I don't know. Michelle Monaghan's kid looks so much like Michelle Monaghan's kid. 2002, her name's Maisie, right? The younger kid?
Yeah, Maisie.
Like, there has never been a child that's looked more like their fake parent than this kid. It's unbelievable.
So how about all the stuff with Marty's daughters never really coming to fruition? Did that bug you?
No, I sort of thought about it as maybe...
Don't be an asshole to women your whole life?
No, just... I don't know, maybe something in the school or whatever, sticking in their head or something, you know? Like, maybe... Was there ever a kidnapped kid in their school or a kid that disappeared in their school? I don't think they talk about it, but that's sort of, it's like it could have been something like that, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. No, I just, with kind of you saying that maybe it was, you know, Michelle Monaghan's dad had something to do with it.
Oh, yeah.
Point to the very sexualized nature of some of the things that Marty's kids do is maybe a... indicative of that.
Yep.
Okay, season 2?
Yep.
Any good?
Well, I don't know, because one thing that I find with, or that I've found kind of interesting with this show, and our friend Emily pointed this out as well. I mean, it's very heavily influenced by Twin Peaks. They've said as much, and the response to it has been very Twin Peaks-ish as well. It's sort of
Just culty?
Yeah, it's turned. Well, no, it's turned into a sensation as it's been on. Like Twin Peaks, when its first season premiered, was a huge hit. Like there's a Rolling Stone cover with three of the women from that show on it, and it was a real sensation. And once they solved the murder in the show, the ratings really, really declined, and the show ended up disappearing pretty quickly. But it was this big thing for a while, and people didn't love the resolution of the Twin Peaks murder, I don't think. I mean, I was six when it happened, but my understanding is that when the supernatural elements came into play, people sort of were like, I'm not all right with that.
Yeah.
And yeah, and people were disappointed with the ending, kind of like the very little research I've done on the reception of this episode. Or this past episode has been kind of similar. Like people seem to be kind of disappointed that there wasn't a big twist revelation or something like that. And I found that kind of interesting. And there's even a direct homage in the church, the broken down church. There's a painting of an owl on the wall, I believe, in True Detective, and owls are very important to Twin Peaks. But yeah, I'm curious to know where they go from here. Because if time really is a flat circle, things are supposed to peter out in season two with True Detective, as far as culturally and all that. Because right now it's pretty close to the way people have reacted to Twin Peaks and True Detective. I think the best idea for season two of True Detective is to be very different.
Yeah. Oh, I think so.
Like, I don't
place new murder. Like, I mean, not even a new murder. Like, something much different, I think.
No, two different detectives re-looking at the Dora Lang case.
And, same murder.
Yeah, and it turns out Rust and Marty were corrupt the whole time.
They did it.
Yeah. I love when the two cops in 2012 kind of dance around accusing Rust of Dextering. I like that a lot.
Yeah.
But no, I think, like, I don't need necessarily two leads in season two. You know, if you can make a compelling show with one lead or a compelling show with three leads, like, that's cool. Just, and I think this is the show that would be okay with fucking around a bit and changing the format. And I assume, the next season will be in like a big city, or at least a city, you know?
And I think we get women.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's probably true.
Yeah. And I mean, you need one character to say odd shit, like you can smell a psychosphere, or that you're in someone's faded memory. So we need one of those characters.
Yeah, no, I know there does need to be some sort of... as far as like I think some of the... because I sort of looked at True Detective season one, it's very much a story about Rust and Marty, and I think that's sort of the resolution of it really drives that home. But it's kind of a problem with these types of media that if it's about a male perspective, then often the women are going to get the shorter shrift. But I mean, even if we look at Maggie's introduction into the show, she gets like the Lost in Translation introduction. Like, we see her ass before we see her face, and it's like that's pretty hard to dance around, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
You surprised by how big this could get in 8 weeks?
Nope.
Is the internet
cool at Donald? No, I just sort of, because the reason I started watching as quickly as I did, I suspected it had a 50% chance of being very good, because I didn't think I don't know, it just sort of had a good feeling about it. And Sin Nombre is a good movie, which is Cary Fukunaga's first movie, and I like Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson, so it was just appealing for that. But at least 50% of the reason why I started watching on the first day was because I felt like it would be a fun 8-week experiment in watching society react to something. And we talked about this a lot on our Breaking Bad podcast. One of my favorite things about the last season of Breaking Bad was that I was watching it with 8 friends simultaneously. And I'm very quick to attach myself to anything that feels like it might be a cultural moment at this point, given that, you know, they seem to come fewer and further between. Also, but True Detective does kind of diminish some of the points I made about that on Breaking Bad, because I kind of hypothesized that Mad Men would be the last thing, but apparently not, and I'm cool with that.
Well, Mad Men still might be the last thing, right?
Yeah, it might be, but I don't think it will be. And Mad Men won't reach the levels that Breaking Bad did.
Yeah. No. But yeah, no, for like just a essentially a 2-month show to get as much steam as it did, you know, after, I think after 4 episodes, people are really getting behind this, and the fact that it's an HBO show too, so it's less accessible.
Yeah, I think the after the 3rd episode, they took a week off for the Super Bowl. And the 3rd episode ends in a very, it's the one where we see
Ledoux,
yeah, with the mask and the terrible freeze frame ending. But it's just sort of like, we have no real context for it. It's just like at the end of the dream, at the end of the nightmare, there's always a monster or something like that. And then it's like, oh, you've got to wait a week. And that's sort of like something that would hype up people that are already watching to tell their friends and then give those friends a week to catch up.
Yeah. Yeah.
So thank the Seattle Seahawks, basically.
Yeah.
They're the 12th man of HBO programming.
And let's hope that steam can keep it going till next season.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm sure it'll the premiere of season 2 of True Detective will be a big deal.
Yeah. When's it going to be?
I don't know. Because, Nick Pizzolatto's made it sound like he's writing currently. But, I mean, they were shooting. When they started shooting, they didn't have the last 2 scripts finished on season 1. So, I think like I do think they finished shooting like last July or something like that. So I don't think it's starting next January, but I don't think it'll be much more than a year away.
Okay.
Yeah.
So. True Detective.
I'm curious to know who directs the second season, though.
Michael Bay.
That'll be the departure we all want. That'll
the
be
the, that they want.
Yeah, finally women will be treated properly.
Thank you, Michael.
Yeah, so thank you for listening to The MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check back next week when we're talking about whatever it is that we're talking about.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.